me. "Aren't you forgetting something?" Another wordless exchange took place, and I fished the little envelope out of my back pocket. I felt the little lump of plastic with my fingers for a single sorrowful moment, then flicked it down the stairs to the lower hallway. This done, I followed Warden into the vent. As I hauled my way through that tight space a second time, I heard a series of metallic thuds from deep within the ship. Then there was the hideous groan of rending metal. I swallowed. Tell me Carlos can't still be alive. That'd just be unfair, wouldn't it? I saw Carlos do many things during my employment, said Warden's arse as it wriggled through the space just ahead of me. I would put nothing past him. I heard another bang as Warden slid into the shuttle, this one more like a balloon bursting on a very large scale, possibly caused by that hull breach in the ballroom opening up again. The failsafes were probably doing their best to isolate it, but all the same, I pulled myself into the shuttle as fast as I could and shut the airlock door. The space inside the shuttle was at even more of a premium with the addition of two new passengers, despite them being underage. I propped an uncomplaining Daniel up against the cabin's rear wall and squeezed myself into the pilot's seat like toothpaste trying to get back into the tube. I couldn't fold my injured leg back in without the pain flaring up, so I just left it dangling over the armrest, where it would continually kick Warden in the arm, with any luck. There was another sound of metal being tormented from somewhere deep within the Jemima, so without further banter, I detached the shuttle with a rather comical popping noise, cranked the speed all the way up, and yanked the steering column hard to the left. So I almost ran us straight into the Star Pilot fleet. They were hanging clustered in space like a gaggle of Roman emperors, waiting to give the thumbs down as soon as the winning gladiator looked up. I recognized more than a couple. Jim Gunn's ship was there, as were the Hopeless Endeavour and the generous curves of Gareth the Overcompensator's freighter, always recognizable by its hot pink spray job. They were big names, which meant they were also the most frequent targets of plagiarism by Jacques McKeown. And judging by the initial scan, every single one of them had their weapons powered up. There was one particular ship that was even easier to recognize than the others. I hailed it, making sure to broadcast the call to every other ship in range. Angelo's muscle-bound silhouette appeared on the communication screen, lit from behind by fluorescent light this time rather than an open fire. I had a feeling that this was a very serious gesture for him.
"Hast thou delivered what thou promised, knave?" he demanded.
"How nice to see you too, Angelo. Why, yes, I am fractionally still alive." He didn't even respond. I sighed. ID scanned that ship. The whale shark, not the Zoob one harpooning it. I could almost detect an increase in radiation in the area between the Jemima and the Star Pilot fleet as every single ship ran the necessary scan. I subtly edged out of the way.
"Jacques McKeown,"
read Angelo from the screen in front of him.
"So thou would abandon the man whose name thou stole aboard a vessel stricken with beasts? To do that even to a betrayer lacks honour."
That wasn't exactly the reaction I'd hoped for.
Hold,
said Angelo, suddenly leaning forward urgently so that his shovel-like face was illuminated by his monitor.
"The creature known as Carlos, the one that slaughtered my comrades, it too is aboard?"
"Oh, yeah." Angelo opened fire with every weapon at his disposal. Two rotary machine guns and two missile tubes sent streams of burning death into the Jemima's exposed underbelly, reopening all the old battle damage. Once he had broken the tension, every other ship joined in. The space between them and the Jemima became a solid cylinder of firepower that poured into the two connected ships like a stream of boiling water onto an ant's nest. If I hadn't moved the shuttle out of the way, we would have been reduced to a puff of shrapnel spreading across creation for eternity. The onslaught of missiles didn't even let up when the chain reactions started. Pounded into submission, the volatile materials in the engines and power reactors did what they did best, sparking off explosion after explosion that gutted the Jemima and the Zoo battleship, reducing them to clouds of white-hot metal and ruined internal fixtures. half a glittering mirror ball sailed past our windshield. It was all rather cathartic. Only then did the star pilot ship stop firing. Angelo sent one last shot into the silence, like he was putting a signature on it or shaking off the last drop at the urinal.
"Our dealings are complete," he said grudgingly, and ended the call.
One by one, the ships drifted away without a word. They were the crowd at the public hanging, dispersing after the adrenaline comes down, uneasy with the guilt of having been part of the moment.
"Jacques McCune is dead," said Warden. "At least as far as your colleagues are concerned. You must be relieved."
"Yeah, things'll be peachy until whoever he is brings another book out, and all these guys ring me up wanting to know what the ply we were all doing out here today."
"You're going to take me back now, aren't you?"
said Jemima, sitting on the floor behind us with her back to the back of my chair.
"Yes, back to Mum. Or alternatively, we could have not come, and left you with the monsters that were trying to eat you," I said, jiggling my injured leg. "You gonna complain?"
"I'm sorry, all right. We just wanted to see more," said Jemima weakly. "I never even left Earth until this trip. Just wanted to get an idea of what else was out there."
"And you did," I said, nodding. I felt I was well within my rights to get good and angry at her, but I was too exhausted to be anything but infuriatingly reasonable. "And then it tried to eat you, because that's what it's like, this exciting star-piloting life you read about. If you want the adventure and romance, you have to also accept that something might come along and start chewing on your head. Or invent something that makes it all pointless," added Warden. I shot her a look that ricocheted straight off her stony gaze, then returned to Jemima. "In the meantime, we have to get you back to the naval fleet. You know, the one you said your mum wouldn't send."
"She won't," said Jemima immediately.
"Ta-da!" I announced, grandly nodding my head toward the scanner screen and the swarm of pixels around Salvation Station that were all coloured in official militaristic green. I wish I'd had my camera out to capture her face. Her lips parted in wonder as she took in the sheer size of the fleet, but then she caught my gaze and leaned back.
"Well, she only sent that because I'm part of her stupid image."
I groaned and slowly leaned forward until my forehead rested on the screen in front of me. "Of course you're part of her image. Doesn't mean you can't be important to her as a daughter as well. It's possible to be more than one thing."
"Yes, take that from Mr. McCune," said Warden, distractedly.
She was half turned in her seat to eyeball Daniel's condition. I didn't let her throw me. "I don't know your mum, but I'm pretty certain that she cares about your safety. That's what the United Republic's all about, isn't it? Keeping everyone safe?"
"Secure might be a better word," said Warden. "I wish I could live in space," said Jemima.
She was sitting with her back to my seat again, and from the way her voice was muffled, she must have brought her knees up to her chest.
"I hate living in the UR. You're getting watched all day and all night. Mum keeps having people blackbagged for complaining about it."
"Would your mother ever blackbag you?" asked Warden.
"No."
"Then maybe you should complain. On behalf of..." Warden suddenly grabbed my dangling leg, and the pain was like someone banging a tin bathtub next to my ear. "McCune, the fleet!" I grimaced. "What fleet?" "The Star Pilot fleet. The ships that came to blow up the Jemima for us. It was not the entire Star Pilot fleet." Jemima, the real one, appeared between us, one hand on each backrest.
"So where's the rest of it?"
Warden pointed to the scanner screen. "They seem to be currently clustered in and around Salvation Station." I squeezed the joysticks and set speed to maximum. "Track. Setting course for whatever they've left of each other." Chapter 27. Salvation Station appeared to be intact, externally at least, but hung alone in the middle of the black without a single ship around it. The entire area covered by the ship's defense systems was utterly lifeless. The Navy fleet were presumably all still cushioning their truncheons, and the residents of the station had all been evacuated to a safe distance. The unaccounted-for component of the Star Pilot fleet was also nowhere to be seen, There were no gutted ships or floating bits of wreckage that I or the shuttle scanners could detect, so apparently Salvation's defences hadn't been deployed. And yet the close-range sensor was absolutely lit up with blips. "There," said Warden, pointing to the docking bay entrance as we neared it. "Mystery solved," I murmured, worried. The entire bay was packed with Starpilot ships of every size and shape. I recognised a couple, but these were mostly the smaller names, the ones who had fewer stories to rip off and consequently less investment in the lynching of Jacques McKeown. Very little care had been taken to park inside the lines, and we were forced to land the shuttle in the far corner, where the rear thrusters caused considerable trauma to a no-smoking sign. We left the ship in pairs, Warden lending me a shoulder to take the weight off my leg, a gesture that should be attributed more to the need for expedience than anything else, as she was quick to point out, while Jemima pulled a still catatonic Daniel along like a dog walker with a particularly dozy terrier. My concerns grew when we passed through the docking bay entrance into the concourse, because something had done serious damage to the doors. They were buckled and dented, and a large number of boots had made a concerted effort to widen the door frame. The nice new floor of the concourse beyond was tarnished with the very same scuff marks that would have so distressed United Republic regulations. But at least it gave us a trail to follow, and finally some sign of life became evident. There was a noisy bustle coming from up ahead. As we rounded the curve, we saw a small mob of star pilots in the wide plaza in front of the Quantunnel gate. They were clustered around something, and it was very easy to imagine it being Robert Blaze sprawled upon the floor, getting a boot to the teeth every time he tried to explain that he didn't know where Jemima was. I hurried as best I could with a dodgy leg and Warden weighing me down, but as we drew nearer, things recontextualized. I could see Blaze, not on his knees or stricken by tormentors, but standing upright in the middle of the throng, wreathed with fatherly smiles. And as we drew even nearer, the clamour of voices could be separated out into a storm of individual questions. "How many more pilots do you need?" one pilot was asking. "Where are the refueling stations?" asked another. "I might have some outstanding convictions in Ritsuko. Is that going to be a problem?" a third, rather anxious-looking pilot asked. Blaze answered whatever questions he could make out with suave confidence, reassuring concerns, and directing gazes toward features. Maybe I was a little delirious at that point, but for a moment he looked like some kind of messiah in the marketplace, surrounded by love-struck peasants fighting to touch his holy hems. "I told you," I said, heard only by Warden. "Star pilots are star pilots, even when they're acting like mercenaries." "Hmm," she replied, heard only by me. "I can't help but feel that you will remember this moment differently if it transpires that Robert Blaze is Jacques McKeown." As I mulled that one over, Warden detached from me, leaving me to lean on a nearby planter that I found much better company. "Gentlemen," she said, in a schoolmarm voice that pierced right through the clamour and caused the crowd between us and Blaze to part like the Red Sea. "We have some internal station matters to discuss. If you would all feel free to explore, we can consider your futures here later." Most of the pilots obeyed, spreading out to wander the evacuated halls, staring enraptured in all directions. The relief that radiated from Blaze when he saw the kids almost had physical presence. "Miss Warden," he breathed, shaking her hand earnestly. "Mr.... He confidently stretched the same hand toward me, but it wobbled a little when he noticed the state I was in. "Dear God, are you all right? What happened?" I gave him my most sarcastic smile. "Ran into some old friends of yours. Zoobs. We found them just as they were making a very convincing case to Jemima and Daniel that the Black isn't as safe as they'd been led to believe." He hung his head. "All right, you've made your point. Maybe it was presumptuous of me to start preparing the Black for visitors before it was fully secured. But we had no choice. Money is always tight. I had to create the Cantrabarget experience because we needed a source of income as quickly as possible." "But that's not going to be an issue any more, is it?" said Warden, quietly enough to be heard only by the three of us. "Because you transferred all of Jacques McKeown's money from that ID chip before you returned it to us." Two jaws hit the floor with almost perfect synchronicity, mine and Blaze's. "How did you know?" he began. "Partly because it was what I would have done," said Warden, wearing the specific expressionless face I'd come to recognise as her smug one. "Mainly from how you reacted just now." "You still have the money," I said, stomach churning. The knowledge that all the money had died with Carlos had left me with a little sorrow, but once I'd thought about it properly, a great deal of relief as well. Now I felt like a dumbfounded hobbit, watching his friend refusing to throw that plying ring into Mount Doom. His smile became rather fixed and desperate. He clutched his temples with both hands, then stretched them toward me, jerking them in time with his words as he thought on the fly. "Well, it's just... you knew that you weren't actually entitled to..." "And you are," I interrupted. "Actually, shall we call all those pilots back over before you answer that question?" He made some kind of coughing noise as a reply, but it was drowned out by a considerably louder noise, a deep metallic rattling, like a rumble of nearby thunder, that startled everyone present into looking at the Quantunnel gate that Blaze and his people had been constructing, had been suddenly being the operative words. "When the hell did you finish that thing?" I said, various predictions for the coming events running through my head as the shutters came down and crashed noisily into the floor. "While you were on Cantrabarjit," said Blaze distantly, eyes fixed upon the grand metal archway. "Who let the shutters down?" He was met by clusters of blank, concerned looks. Any thought that they might have loosened accidentally disappeared when the shutters started shaking and making the telltale clangs of a Quantunnel being activated. Presumably the actual tunnelling firmware wasn't installed, but only the origin gate required that, not the destination. That was how they'd been used to colonize distant space. Just fly an unmanned gate as far as you can, without needing to worry about keeping anything on board alive, connect to it from back home and pop through at your leisure. The noises had caused a smaller version of the earlier crowd to reform, but when the gate fell silent, the entire room did likewise. The tension built up on our heads and shoulders like a cascade of unpleasant sleet, freezing us in place and slipping uncomfortably down our collars, before the shutters finally opened to reveal a rather generic military-grade transport bay that I didn't recognise. Although I certainly recognised the platoon of soldiers in black armour, because they were dressed identically to the ones I'd encountered trying to truncheon their way into the Jemima back on Earth. The moment the shutter was up, there was a mass eruption of chaos. The soldiers poured into the station with a storm of thudding feet. I noticed at more or less this point that their boots were all wrapped in canvas sacks, screaming for everyone to display their hands. A number of the pilots, including that anxious-looking one who had spoken earlier, immediately attempted to flee the scene. Those of us who were nearer the gate, including Blaze, Warden, and myself, were grabbed and pushed to the ground, with the cushioned end of a rifle held against our temples. The more outlying pilots were merely held at bay by an efficiently established perimeter, although the soldiers threw a few more individuals to the floor for displaying offensive behaviour, such as looking at them funny. I saw Warden open her mouth to come up with some devastating legal threat, but she was screamed into silence by the owner of the gun pressed to her head. And barely 5 seconds after they had entered the room, everything was still and silent again. I could only admire the efficiency of the United Republic's military as a gun barrel lodged in my cheek and ground my face into Salvation's brand new floor. The cuts in my forehead were throbbing again. I was in a perfect position to watch the President of the United Republic step through the gate onto the station, or at least her lower half, which was wearing what looked like men's formal shoes and a grey pinstriped suit. With slow, deliberate, measured steps, she approached the soldier pinning Robert Blaze and knelt cautiously beside them, as if regarding a turd the dog had left on the carpet. Now that she had crouched into my visual range, I could see that she was quite a small woman, not much more than 5 feet in height, with a helmet of tightly brushed brown hair and a complexion almost as orange as Henderson's. There must have been something up with the artificial sun at Cloud Castle, which Jemima and Daniel were spared from because they never left the house. "I only have one question," she said in a soft voice. "I am willing to ask it as many times as are necessary.
Where is my daughter?
She's over there, said Blaze, trying to point through the use of eyeballs alone.
I said, where is my...
What?
I'm over here, Mum,
said an unhappy Jemima from somewhere behind me, apparently having hidden herself among the onlookers. She stepped forward to a point just in front of my face, and her mother walked smartly over and hugged her in a rather perfunctory manner I felt was more for the benefit of outside observers than either participant. When they parted, she was clutching both of Jemima's shoulders.
Where are you hurt?
Her question turned a little uncertain toward the end as she saw that Jemima wasn't exactly sobbing with gratitude, but was directing an unhappy, tight-lipped gaze downward.
I'm not hurt, Mum. I wasn't kidnapped.
The President of the United Republic shot looks of hatred all around.
Which one kidnapped you? I'll make sure they...
I wasn't kidnapped, Mum! Jemima finally looked her in the eye.
Dan got a new ship and we decided to go exploring in it. It was my idea.
Your... She made several confused pseudo-words as she attempted to update the internal image she had of her daughter.
Why didn't you tell me where you were?
Jemima's voice shook, growing in volume and confidence.
I didn't think you'd care that much!
She gestured vaguely at me and everyone else currently making out with floor tiles.
And I didn't think you'd, you know, completely flip out at the people who saved me.
Saved you? I only realized that the little switch in my head had flipped on after I heard words coming out of my own mouth. Yeah, you're lucky we found them when we did, Mom. They flew straight into unpacified territory. The President detached her hands from Jemima's shoulders, presumably because she would need them to get a proper grip on events. She made a meaningful jerk of the wrist, and my new soldier friend pulled me to my feet, his rifle's laser sight maintaining a lurid red pimple on my forehead.
You are? Asked the President.
Captain... My eyes flicked to the side for less than a nanosecond. Handsome. Of the Star Pilot Volunteer Peacekeeping Corps. I saluted, trying my best to not let it look sarcastic like my salutes usually do.
I've never heard of such an organization, said the President.
She seemed a lot less confident than she had been when she walked in. She was fidgeting with her elbows and her gaze was darting all over the place. I guessed that she was taking in the shiny new surroundings and drawing some conclusion along the lines of, this doesn't look much like a pirate ship. We're very new, I explained. 2 seconds old, to be precise, I thought to myself. Please accept my apologies for not rescuing your daughter sooner. There's a lot of space to patrol out here, and we don't have much funding. The President scrutinized me through narrowed eyelids.
How exactly are you funded?
Robert Blaze made an embarrassed little laugh into the piece of flooring against which his face was being held. With difficulty. The President took a few dazed steps backward.
Daniel's father told me that he and Jemima had been kidnapped by space pirates.
Well, I don't know what to tell you, I said, scratching my head. This guy who told you that, would you consider him trustworthy? Or has he ever done anything that might make you think he's a bit dishonest? Or a bit manipulative? Her face froze with the kind of embarrassment known mainly to people being informed moments after launching an elaborate surprise party that they got the recipient's birth date wrong, but with the added spicy undercurrent of diplomatic faux pas. The pinkness to her features became vibrant enough to be detected even through her orange tan. She made that hand gesture again, several times like an irritated conductor. Let them up. Let them all up. And stand down. The baffled soldiers followed her orders. Warden was the first back on her feet, straightening her clothing and brushing a couple of hairs back in place. Blaze stood slowly, making sure to keep up his winning, inoffensive smile throughout. With their guns lowered, the soldiers transformed immediately from an elite platoon securing a hostile area to a congregation of extremely embarrassed, overdressed men. Jemima, we're leaving, said the President, in a manner of speech that involved moving the mouth as little as possible, as she moved back toward the open gate. Jemima stepped forward automatically, head bowed and hands gathered before her, as soon as the words registered. but then her conscious mind got in on the action, and her pace slowed and stopped. She met my gaze, then turned back to her mother.
"Aren't you going to apologize?"
A weighty silence fell. The president seemed to have completely frozen stiff but for her eyes, whose gaze darted madly around the room, resting briefly on every face that stared at her expectantly. This, I realized, was a woman who had spent far too long in politics. I could almost hear the whirring of the gears in her head as she analyzed the possible outcomes. If she didn't apologize, she risked offending some kind of foreign authority. But an apology from the president herself would be considered an official one, and that raised all kinds of issues. Would it be politically unsavvy to make such a statement without the blessing of her advisers or cabinet? Would it be considered an endorsement of this group that could still be pirates, albeit well-scrubbed ones? Would other groups be offended that we had received an apology? Would the pundits accuse her of being improperly dressed for contrition? Let's face it, she was only here in person in the name of some vote-winning show of personal strength and determination, I could tell. There were probably quite a few people back home who had already been sold the story that she was riding in, saber held high, to rescue her daughter from the oily clutches of subhuman off-worlders. Forget apologies. Those people were going to froth at the mouth if she didn't come home with a necklace of testicles. Jemima untensed with a sigh, then addressed Robert Blaze.
"We're really sorry about, you know, all the soldier stuff."
Blaze said nothing, but he gave her an extra special smile and nod that would have melted the heart of any woman of age like butter under napalm. Then Jemima turned to me again, and the next thing I knew, she was hugging me. And this hug had a lot more warmth and friendship on her part than the one she had shared with her mother moments earlier. I met the president's gaze over Jemima's pink head and gave an apologetic grimace. She broke off, not looking me in the eye, then saw Warden. There was a moment's hesitation, which Warden ended by extending a hand to shake. Jemima took it, chastely. Warden had been the one to initiate the kidnapping, after all. I supposed it took saving her life from slime monsters to graduate from handshake to hug. Jemima stepped past her still unmoving mother, through the Quantunnel gate, and into the hangar beyond. The soldiers seemed to take this as their cue to leave, too, and the rifles came up again. They slowly backpedaled toward the gate, shouting for us to not move throughout, all in accordance with some, no doubt, vitally important code of conduct. After they had formed a rectangle directly in front of the president, they swept her through the Quantunnel gate like a broom. I saw Jemima give one last wave before the shutters came down. A minute of awkward silence passed before Blaze ordered the shutters reopened, and a sigh of relief was collectively released when there was nothing beyond but the far wall that was supposed to be there. This established, he rubbed his hands together happily and turned back to us. "Well, I think that wraps up our temporary crisis," he said. "Unless there's anything I'm forgetting about." "Are you Jacques McKeown?" I asked. The assembled star pilots that hadn't none too subtly legged it upon the appearance of the soldiers had mostly already drifted back to inspecting the station, it taking quite a lot to seriously rattle veteran star pilots, so it was near enough just Blaze and Warden left to hear my question. Blaze's neck and arms immediately went limp, as if his puppet strings had been cut. "Look, I'm really, really, really tired, and my everything hurts, and we just more or less saved your ass," I said, limping closer. "So I'd be grateful if you answered the plying question before I pass out." He gave me a sorrowful half-smile and touched me gingerly on the shoulder. "Come with me. Let's talk." Warden made the slightest movement to follow us, but I stopped her with a look that made it very clear how little track I was going to put up with at this point. She hung back, conceding this particular wordless argument. He led me to an isolated spot just behind one of the arms of the Quantunnel archway, then began to pace in a small, slow circle around me, thinking. I watched him with a varied mixture of feelings. The constant warm thrill I had from being around my idol clashed with my newer sense of betrayal, and they were joined by a quieter little nagging thought that I had just accompanied him alone to an ideal spot for concealed throat-slitting. "I'm not Jacques McKeown," he said eventually. "But..." He seemed to dry up there for a while, so I gave him the prompt. "But you know who he is." He winced and wobbled a splayed hand non-committally. 99% certain. "And before you ask, I'm not going to tell you." "Why not?" "Because I don't hate Jacques McKeown. He and I have more or less the same goal." He looked up as if he could see through the concourse ceiling to the stars beyond. "We want to keep the memory of star piloting alive." "But the memories are wrong," I protested. "They're not real. And those kids bought into the myth and almost got themselves eaten by zoobs." Blaze clasped his hook with his good hand, face darkening. "Yes, all right, you've made your point. There's still a lot of work to be done. But there won't always be zoobs or pirates." "And what happens after they're all gone?" He gave me an odd look. "Do you know what I realized when I left the solar system? After quantunneling put us all out of work, and I had to see all our peers debasing themselves in Ritsuko City spaceport, I realized that the job of a hero is not to save the galaxy, or rescue princesses, or slay all the dragons. That may be part of it, but in the end a hero only has one job, and that's to make himself unnecessary." I looked at the floor. "If you say so." "Quantunneling took that away from us, but out here we make ourselves unnecessary on our own terms. That's how I see it." I coughed. "Can I be honest?" "Of course." "I still think you might be Jacques McKeown." He did the cut puppet strings gesture again. "Look, what can I possibly do to convince you?" "You could give all of Jacques McKeown's money back," I said, expressionless, "since you want me to believe that you have absolutely no claim to it." For the first time in our personal acquaintance, I saw Robert Blaze show anger. A momentary twist of the corners of the mouth that he adeptly suppressed by pinching his eyes and taking a deep breath. "No, I am not entitled to the money, and neither are you. But the money is in my hands, and I have an important purpose in mind. So if you want it, you are going to have to fight me for it." "I don't want to fight you for it. I want you to give it to me, willingly, after I tell you what I'm going to do with it." He frowned. "What are you going to do with it?" I told him. Only one loose end remained, and a few minutes later, Warden and I were leading him back to the docking bay. Daniel was conscious enough to be walking by himself as long as we pulled him by the arm, but he still hadn't said anything, and his petrified gaze continued to be fixed on some invisible tormentor hanging permanently in front of his eyes. "You want to do this right now," I said. "As long as Daniel is on board, Mr. Henderson remains a threat to the station," said Warden, "and I cannot fly a shuttle by myself." "Right, right. Just thought I might be entitled to at least a nanosecond of rest first. But there's me getting ideas above my station. Where are we taking him?" "One of the outlying solar system outposts. I can tip off one of my more reasonable contacts with the Henderson organization to pick him up." "Are there reasonable people in Henderson's organization? 'Cause so far I've met him and you, and from that sample it's not looking good." She was glancing around distractedly, not paying attention. "What? Never mind. Speaking of contacts, do you think you could get me a new ID, Chip?" I waved my steel-bandaged hand. "Nothing fancy. Just something that lets me use a bank account and park at Ritsuko Spaceport." Her eyes focused on the bloodstain in the center of the bandage, now long dried brown, and one eyebrow came up. "And this is something you feel that I owe you, is it? Look, you're going to have a go at working with Blaze, right? This is for a plan me and Blaze have for the McKeown money. Stop turning it into some psycho-div power play." We entered the docking bay. It was still empty of people, but crowded with badly parked ships, so making our way through the overlapping nacelles, wings and landing gear to the shuttle was like exploring a haunted forest. "Fine," said Warden. "And will you be wanting one of your old names for it, or do you think it's time for another fresh start?" Daniel's head banged musically on a low-hanging engine flap, since we were dragging him along without paying much attention, and Warden started at the noise, dropping into an alert crouch. Her hand slipped inside her suit jacket for a moment to grab the hilt of my blaster, which she was showing no sign of wanting to give back. "Keep it down!" "Look, is there something on your mind?" I asked, carefully moving an unreactive Daniel's head around the obstacle. Warden glared and very, very slowly rose from her combat position. It occurred to me that there are very few explanations for how the United Republic knew that Salvation Station had a completed Quantanal gate, she said, still looking around for threats. We had reached the shuttle by this point, and she took up position by the airlock door as I fumbled with the lock. "What are you getting at?" I said. "That Henderson may already have agents on or around the station." I froze in the act of turning the handle. I took a few paranoid glances of my own around the docking bay, then spoke in a much quieter voice. "And you didn't think this was worth mentioning until now? To be frank, McKeown, I thought it might have been you." I pinched my eyes in exasperation, just as Blaze had done earlier, and took a deep breath. "Of course you did." When I opened my eyes, Warden appeared to have grown two additional arms. Then I blinked and realized that there was actually someone standing behind her. It was a man dressed in the uniform of the Interplanetary Security Service, and he had one hand on her forehead, pulling her head back. His other hand was holding a box cutter to her exposed neck. I'd only just finished registering all of that when I heard the faintest of noises behind me, and a calloused palm slapped against my own forehead, almost as a gesture of admonishment. A box-cutter blade touched my Adam's apple as I was forced to take an interest in the ceiling. "So what do you make of this?" I said, with difficulty. "It invites deeper consideration," replied Warden. Chapter 28. With some firm prodding in the small of the back, my captor made me walk. I let him steer me as I focused all my concentration on moving forward just slowly enough to not open my throat on his blade. With every step, a cold point pecked lightly at my jugular vein like an indecisive woodpecker. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Warden being moved alongside me, and behind us, a third ISS officer was leading Daniel along. As the mind seeks distractions in these moments, I wondered why they were using box cutters rather than their standard-issue ISS blasters. Then I remembered that the ISS bureaucracy was strictly diligent about keeping track of issued ammunition and how it was used. The measures had been a response to the internal corruption that had arisen since the rise of Quantunling, evidenced clearly enough by the fact that officers were doing side jobs for Henderson. We turned a corner, and before us, squatting at the end of a tunnel of parked ships, the ISS ship lay in wait. The very same one that Henderson had commandeered to rescue us from Angelo way back before our first trebuchet jump into the black. As we approached, the docking ramp began to lower, with what must have been deliberate slowness. Inch by inch, Henderson was revealed, partially silhouetted against the red warning light of the airlock. He looked awful. His well-brushed hair was bedraggled, and from the darkening around his empty eyes, I doubted he had slept at all since we'd seen him last. His mouth smiled joylessly. He had discarded the reindeer sweater for a melancholy blue one with a single frowning snowman. "I do hope we had a good vacation, boys and girls," he said, voice quivering a little, as he descended the fully extended docking ramp with his hands behind his back. "Daniel, over here." I wasn't sure if it was a greeting to his son or an instruction to the officer holding him, but either way, the pair moved past us and took up position at Henderson's side. He gave his son's hair a tussle, holding his hand there a little longer than necessary, maintaining eye contact with Warden throughout. Assured that his son was safe, relief flowed through Henderson's body, untensing muscles as it went, although his face didn't change. "You know," he said slowly, after a nice, long stare, "I respect a certain amount of independent spirit. I seem to attract a lot of yes-men to my circle of subordinates. It makes it very hard to have a decent conversation. So understand, that I cherish these moments, and also understand that I'm really looking forward to seeing what kind of pressure I can get your blood spraying at. I was trembling. The point of the box cutter tickled my throat as I did so. I couldn't see much of Warden with my head held in place, but I could tell that her lips were pressed defiantly closed. Henderson chuckled hollowly at her expression. He took a step forward and put a hand to his chin, one finger tapping his cheek in mock contemplation. But then again, that would be over so quickly, wouldn't it? I feel like really making a project out of this, you know? Seeing how much of you I could turn into a model train set while keeping you alive, that kind of thing. What do you think, Danny? When Daniel didn't immediately yell at him for being embarrassing, or indeed make any response at all, Henderson frowned and looked him over properly for the first time since he'd arrived. His mood darkened again. Warden, if you've hurt him in any way, I swear. He left it hanging, and she said nothing. Henderson knelt beside his son, placing his hands on his shoulders to shake them. His concern turned quickly to fear. Danny? Dan? Speak to me. It's Dad.
Dad?
Said Daniel, his eyes focusing, as Henderson held his face in both hands and pushed his cheeks forward.
Danny! What happened?
Daniel frowned, apparently confused by the question. Then his eyes grew wide and urgent, and he spoke, his voice growing in volume along the way.
I had the best time!
Henderson leaned back, stunned, as if Daniel had responded with a headbutt he'd narrowly dodged. What?
I went into space and we got attacked and we got kidnapped by pirates and then I stayed on their station and they fixed my ship and taught me how to fly it, but then we got abducted by aliens and they tried to eat me, but Jacques McKeown came and rescued me and...
He stopped to suck in a fresh lungful of air.
And it was the best holiday ever, Dad, thanks.
Henderson had been gradually leaning backward throughout the speech, and by the end of it he was sitting on the floor, staring open-mouthed. Then he seemed to notice me watching him and quickly got to his feet, flustered.
Well, didn't I tell you to trust your old dad? Get on the ship now, time to go home.
Sure, Dad,
said Daniel, obeying without complaint. Henderson watched him pick his way up the docking ramp, then pointed at each of his henchmen in turn.
You three, go settle him into his cabin. Leave us.
Sir? Asked the one holding me. Henderson's expression froze, and then his cheerful persona returned in an instant.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I forgot you boys are new to working with me. Well, just for future reference, questioning my orders usually results in those orders getting carved into your scalp, okay? So let's try that again. Leave us.
The box cutter blade came away from my throat rather hastily, leaving a light scratch, and the three ISS officers hurried for their ship. Henderson continued staring at them until they'd gone up the ramp, passed through an interior door, and vanished from sight, giving us one last fearful glance. They probably suspected that Henderson was about to do something so horrible to us that he needed maximum plausible deniability. He kept his back to us for some time, tapping his foot.
That, he said, not turning around, has left me kinda thrown. 16 years, nothing but yelling and I want this and I want that and you're so embarrassing. I've never heard him say thanks. Not once. I never even realized that till now.
He fell back into silence for so long that I wondered if he was expecting one of us to reply. But then he shook himself and let his arms drop to his sides.
Oh, well.
Then he was on me. He spun around before I could blink and grabbed my shoulder in a vice-like grip. Then his other hand thrust forward, cassowary talon exposed. My head reflexively shot back, but the claw stopped an inch in front of where my eye had been. Henderson's face was close enough that I could almost feel radiation coming off his orange skin, and his smile was pulled tight.
No, he said. Not you. Can't do that to him. Not now. You get to live.
He patted me companionably on the shoulder with his gripping hand, then spun off me and toward Warden. Again he grabbed her around the shoulder, and again his talons stopped moments before it hit. Warden didn't recoil. Henderson wasn't even looking at her. His smile was quivering oddly, like he was about to burst out laughing, but there was moisture in his eyes. "Gah!" he exclaimed as he let her go, tottering back and grinning sheepishly. "Can't do it. Not feeling it anymore. I'm just too chuffed. Normally I'd cut out your finger bones and shove them up your noses until they hit brain just out of principle, but... ooh, I'm going to regret this by morning, I just know." His face unexpectedly went completely serious, and he gave us both a death glare. "If I ever see either of you again, I'm going to start blowing your limbs off before a single word is uttered. But as of now, I'm going to leave and let live. Say thank you, Mr. Henderson." "Thank you, Mr. Henderson," I said. Warden remained silent. The death glare immediately went away again. He clapped his hands, having retracted the talon, and rubbed them together, grinning happily at Warden's stony face. "Well then, I think I'll leave you big bad pirates to pick fleas off each other or whatever else you do in this cesspit. I have to find a bathroom with a functioning bidet." "Mr. Henderson," said Warden, as he reached the base of the ramp, finally breaking her silence. He stopped and half-turned, grin on full display. Then she blew his leg off. She'd quietly drawn my pistol while his back was turned, and now fired all the remaining charge in one blast, deliberately aiming at the floor by Henderson's foot. It wasn't solve all immediate problems level, but it was enough to warp the floor tiles and detach his right leg just below the knee. The rest of him fell back against the docking ramp, his mouth wide open, as his eyes boggled at the smoke rising from his new stump. Then the pain hit, and his silent scream transitioned into a very, very noisy one. Henderson's leg, meanwhile, had landed just in front of us. Warden took two smart steps forward and picked it up by the ankle, keeping the gun trained on Henderson. "If I ever see you, or any of your agents, on this station or anywhere in the Black," she said, in a tone of voice like she was merely laying out conditions for a business deal, "then I, too, will start blowing off limbs. Or rather, resume." "You're dead!" shrieked Henderson, clutching his knee. "You're dead! You're dead! You're dead!" The phrase appeared to be his equivalent of "ow." Warden hefted Henderson's leg like a stick grenade and threw it over his head into the red-lit gloom of the ship's docking bay. He tried to follow it with his gaze, stunned. "I would move quickly if I were you," she said. "This station lacks the facilities for limb reattachment, and you may still have time." "You're dead!" Henderson shuffled his way up the ramp through a combination of hand plants, butt shuffles, and kicks of the remaining leg. Once he had established a rhythm, he screamed in time with it. "You're dead! You're dead! You're dead!" Warden jerked the gun once Henderson was in the cargo bay, and he started fearfully. He couldn't reach the ramp controls from the floor, so he picked up his disembodied leg and slapped at the close button with it. Warden kept the sights on him right up until the ramp clunked into place and he disappeared from sight. Moments later, exactly the amount of time it would take to yell an order down a corridor, the ISS ship's takeoff jets activated, and it gingerly extracted itself from the nest of badly parked vessels. Then the horizontal thrusters kicked in with a burst like the yelping of a kicked dog, and it sped through the force field into space. Warden relaxed. She let all the air out of her lungs in one long blast that seemed to go on for minutes, and when she was finished, she looked like she had lost a couple of inches of height. She offered me my gun, hilt first. "I think we are finally free of Henderson's influence." Her little smile disappeared when she saw the look on my face. "Do you know what?" I said, carefully taking the gun with the tips of my thumb and forefinger, as if I were picking it out of a patch of stinging nettles. "I don't agree." Chapter 29. Ritsuko City Spaceport welcomes visitors to Luna, the cradle of human spacegoing, droned the loudspeaker. "All visitors are reminded that they are under no obligation to charter unemployed star pilots." The words were surprisingly clear, and becoming more so every day. The lines of star pilots at either side of the concourse had thinned out, to the point that their combined voices could no longer match the loudspeaker's maximum volume. There was even enough room for everyone to have something to sit on, other than each other. Most of the star pilots who were still here were getting old. They were stubborn, more set in their ways, or perhaps just resigned to having done all they needed to do in the universe. Most of the younger ones had gone to salvation. The pilot I was specifically keeping an eye on was an aging man with a goatee that had probably looked much cooler before his hair had receded to the top of his crown. He wore a weather-beaten flight jacket, adorned with a large patch on the back, depicting a red cylinder with a sparking fuse. Richard Deneuve, a.k.a. Dick Dynamite. He'd named himself unironically, as far as I knew. The Golden Age had been a more innocent time. I cringed a little at his choice of location, right next to the potted plant where he couldn't be seen from the gate, but not all of us had adjusted well to the new age. Dick certainly looked undernourished, but I was more concerned about whether or not the kid I'd temporarily employed was actually going to complete the task. To my relief, I saw him then, moving across the concourse at right angles to the rest of the crowd. He was one of the Jacques McKeown fanboys that hung around the bookstore, so the hope that illuminated Dick's eyes when he saw someone approaching died the moment he took in the distressed flight jacket and self-conscious swagger. But that disappointment shifted quickly to confusion as the kid held out a thick padded envelope. I couldn't hear their conversation, but presumably the kid's words were something along the lines of, "Some guy told me to give this to you." Dick asked the kid something, probably something like, "Are you sure you have the right man?" And the kid pointed to the envelope, which was very clearly printed with the words, "Richard Dick Dynamite Deneuve, Star Pilot." Then Dick asked who this was from, and if the kid could follow instructions properly, he'd reply, "Some guy. I didn't see his face." Finally, Dick opened the envelope, and as he perused the contents, the kid melted back into the crowd, in full accordance with my instructions. I breathed a sigh of relief. This was the first time I'd used this method. Last time I'd left the envelope on the recipient's docking steps, and the time before that snuck it into a load of freshly tumble-dried laundry at Frobisher's. I didn't want to start getting predictable. Dick pulled out the topmost item in the envelope and stared at it, baffled. It was a copy of Jacques McKeown and the Judgment of Juvon. Juvon was a planet on the direct opposite end of the Black to Cantrabarjit, divided between two distinct cultures. The more bellicose one was constantly attempting to subjugate the other, and ground was being gained and lost on a daily basis. The conquest had come closest to succeeding in the last major war, but the aggressors had been foiled at the last moment by the intervention of a star pilot. Dick was very familiar with the place, because he had been the star pilot in question, and his story had been ineptly fictionalized in the book that he now held. I could only imagine what he thought the intended message was, until he saw what else was in the envelope. His hands clenched tightly, scrunching the envelope closed, and he bit his lip so hard I thought he might draw blood. Judgment of Juvon had been of middling popularity for a McKeown book, meaning that most publishers would have considered it a success worthy of immediate and lengthy retirement to their own personal cocaine farm. It had earned McKeown himself about 800,000 euro yen, determined from the book sales figures on record, his contractual profit share, and one or two educated guesses. But the book itself was only there in the envelope to explain the rest of the contents. 800,000 euro yen, in tightly bound stacks of untraceable cash. Dick held his prize close to his chest, looking left and right to see if anyone else had seen. That was a fairly typical reaction, as was his next. He speed-walked away, forgetting to take his cardboard sign with him. "And what do you think he's going to do with that?" I'd been watching Dick so intently that I hadn't noticed Warden arrive and sit opposite me. She was wearing a new suit, something with a slightly more daring dull brown colour scheme to reflect her new position as corporate advisor to the frontiers. I leaned back, sighed, and took a long sip on my coffee before I replied. "I don't know. Never work again?" Warden leaned back as well, checking her nails for a moment, determined not to look less relaxed. "Or drink it away?" she said. "Or get cheated out of it?" I rolled my eyes. "Or blow it on pimping out his ship? Or throw it straight in the bin? Lofty Doc did that. He was always one for the prideful gesture. I don't care what they do with it. The point is, the choice is in their hands. And more than one of them made the choice to donate it all back to Salvation Station. It might have been quicker and more efficient just to leave it all with Blaze. I wrinkled my nose. What are you doing here, anyway? Ritsuko City's Henderson's turf. He's been building his power base since the moment he got back. I only just quantunneled in, and I'll be quantunneled out by the time he hears about it. The corner of Warden's mouth curled up very slightly, in her usual poor imitation of a smile. Besides, he has shown me too many of his weaknesses, and we have eyes and ears wherever there are star pilots. I exhaled angrily, through bared teeth. I thought you were Henderson's victim, not one of his protégés. I didn't help you get away from him so you could turn Salvation into some kind of rival crime family. Blaze is the one in charge, McKeown? I showed her my scarred hand, where she'd implanted the bootleg ID chip. It's Dashford Pierce now, remember? And Blaze is an old man, in a dangerous part of the galaxy. Don't think I haven't realized that you realize that. Bit by bit, her expression changed. Just a millimeter's movement here and there to turn her smugness down half a notch and put a few emotional walls back up. I take it there's no point in offering you a position again, then? Is that why you're here? She stared out at the concourse to where Dick Dynamite had stood. Blaze asked me. Well, officially, he believes in your project and just wants to know how it's going and if you need anything. But I can tell what he really wants. We have also been contacted by the United Republic, wanting to set up a meeting to discuss what they can do to help the effort. But they specifically want to talk to one Captain Handsome? I gave a little smirk, which I unsuccessfully tried to remove before she saw it. You know, if you do have concerns about my intentions for Salvation Station, said Warden, meeting my gaze again, your best course of action would be to join and keep me under supervision. I returned the look with tired, half-lidded eyes. Cross the black? Help create a place for star pilots in the universe? Hunt zoobs and battle pirates? It's a little golden age all over again. Isn't that what you wanted? I deflated in my seat. I thought it was. When quantunneling started, seemed like all I could think about was wanting things to go back to how they used to be. And back there, for a little while, it was, just for a moment. And then a monster nearly bit my head off. She raised an eyebrow. Surely you don't expect me to believe that you're traumatized now? No, I said automatically. But it brought back a few things. I came pretty close to getting my head bitten off a few times back in the war on Cantrabarjid, too, and 100 other places. What Blaze was trying with the new Cantrabarjid, that might be fake, but no one's getting their head bitten off either. She nodded. You've outgrown it. Maybe. Maybe there never was a golden age. Maybe some glorious delusion of one is the best we can hope for. Do you see what I mean? Frankly, all I can see is a thug who may finally have realized what he was all along. I coughed. Thug? Maybe a little more than that, she said, glancing away in thought. A mercenary? A thief? A con man at best? But if it helps, being a thug is an improvement over being a delusional thug. I glared at her over my new sunglasses. If you're still trying to talk me into something, you're going the wrong way about it. She sniffed. So what will you do now? I produced my new data pad and called up the document that was on near permanent display. I drew a little tick next to Dick Dynamite's name with my finger. Keep going down the list? Keep sharing out the money? And then what? I don't plan ahead, remember? I glanced at the spaceport's quantunnel gate as it opened again, disgorging a new horde of tourists that sent the star pilots into a fresh frenzy. It's like Blaze said, a hero's only job is to make himself unnecessary. She thought about that for a good 5 seconds. An unnecessary man is also a man that nobody will miss. I half smiled with incredulity. Was that a threat? Are you serious? No, I am merely pointing out that a threat exists.
Henderson?
She rolled her eyes and clasped her hands together in front of her, then spoke with a slow, condescending tone. The money that you are giving away belongs to someone.
McKeown, I identified.
Funny, I came pretty close to forgetting that I'm not actually him.
Why would he be a threat? He's never revealed himself before, not even to collect his plying pay. Why should he now?
Perhaps because he is believed to have died in the destruction of the Jemima.
So why would he want to let anyone think otherwise? Everyone knows star pilots would crucify him.
That merest hint of a smile again. She definitely cranked the smugness back up. You may be surprised. The beneficiaries of your campaign. I've heard a couple of them talking at Salvation. They have assumed that they have McKeown to thank for the gifts. They think it may be someone executing his will.
I felt pangs of disappointment. I can see why they would think that, I realized painfully.
So, if we are assuming that his reclusiveness was due to fear of reprisal from star pilots, you may be making it easier and easier for him to take action, as you mend his reputation in their eyes.
I considered the thought for a moment, biting my thumbnail, until a new thought sent it rocketing to the back of my mind. I met her gaze again.
You know who he is?
Blaze might have mentioned something. I kept staring. In that moment I thought my heart might have stopped.
So?
You've met him. McKeown, I mean. At least I'm fairly certain you have.
Any more I see no reason to reveal?
My hands were at my brow.
Why would you plying tell me something like that and then leave me hanging?
She started gathering up her things.
That was merely a courtesy. I am not going to fully share such a valuable piece of intelligence with an unaffiliated party.
She glanced up briefly to see if I'd caught the emphasis.
Well then, I think there's nothing more to discuss for now. You have my number if you ever change your mind.
I think she must have expected me to call her back, or at least throw out some kind of parting shot, because she slowed dramatically when she was a few steps away. But she didn't turn. I let her ramble slowly across the cafe area until she sped her pace up again to join the outgoing spaceport crowd.
Dev, I called, a split second before she left earshot.
The old docking bay at Ritsuko Spaceport was also becoming less and less crowded these days, to the point that the authorities were throwing around the idea of scrapping the booking system. But for the time being, I still had my own bay. I made my way toward it, passing by the ship of one of my beneficiaries. I took a moment to marvel at its new chrome-plated fins and spray artwork depicting a wizard fighting a gorilla in a bra. I could understand the thought behind it, to an extent. Since I'd gotten back to her, I'd been showering the never-die with affection like a cheating spouse trying to make amends. Nothing as flashy, just a new paint job and enough maintenance to put a comfortable distance between it and failing a rigorous safety check. Also, since Jacques McKeown and the Malmind Menace had been no slouch, sales-wise, I'd treated her to a thorough inside-and-out seeing-to by the Lightspeed Cleaning Service, a Frobisher side venture. Now, when I entered and saw her on the far side of the bay, she looked like a bride at the end of the church aisle. Not a young, virginal one, but maybe closer to the mid-30s, one that had filled out nicely, who could challenge and surprise you in all the interesting ways. She stood proud and patient on her landing legs, as if standing with one hand on hip, her hull shining in the light and bearing its dents without shame. I thought about Warden's warning as I crossed the docking bay's expansive floor, hands buried in jacket pockets. Maybe she was right. I was mending the reputation of the great betrayer Jacques McKeown in such a way that I remained the only person who still knew that he was a betrayer, thus ensuring I would have no backup if he did come after me. He'd have to find me first, and that was the point of the whole anonymous drops of untraceable cash thing. But even if he did, what could he do? Have me arrested for stealing his money, perhaps, but that would mean simultaneously revealing himself publicly and tanking his reputation with the pilots again. He could break my kneecaps with a crowbar, but then so could anyone else.
I suppose he could always passive-aggressively base a character on me. The point was he didn't have any kind of power, because he didn't have any money. I'd taken it all. All that he made from the books, anyway. And that thought made me slow for a moment, because it occurred to me that there was one explanation for that, that he hadn't collected the money because he already had enough. By then I was at my ship's airlock, ready to get some shut-eye before making a plan for the next name on my list. But as I lowered the docking steps, a voice called out from nearby. It made me freeze, because it was calling out a name that I didn't go by anymore. Two individuals stepped out from behind the cargo loader parked near my ship. On the left was someone I recognized from the spaceport's internal security staff, with whom I had a passing acquaintance. His mouth was tight and serious, although his eyes were apologetic. On the right was an older man in a shirt and tie, who seemed to have one eyebrow permanently raised in disbelief. He was wearing a shoulder holster with a gun, which the security officer didn't seem to have a problem with. "Are you the registered owner of this vessel?" asked the second man. My gaze flicked from one man to the other as I digested that. The gun and the official language pointed to him being a policeman, or someone very convincingly disguised as a policeman, trying to get close enough to knife me in the gut. "Yes," I said, deciding there was no immediate danger in that, at least. The cop produced an official document and a pair of handcuffs. "I have a warrant for your arrest." "For what?" I attempted to sound incredulous. "Contempt of court." I leaned forward and inspected the text of the document without stepping any closer, but I'd already recalled the jabbering voices of that little doint Ronald and his horrible parents. That felt like years ago. I had a confusing sensation that came from wanting to cry with despair and laugh out loud at the same time. He frowned, apparently picking up on my internal turmoil. "Are you the person named on this warrant, or aren't you?" I could already feel words assembling in my throat. "Oh, that name. No, as you'll see from my chip ID, I am Mr. Dashford Pierce, man about town. The registered owner of this ship, you say? Well, I only bought it a week ago. I did think the guy seemed a bit eager to get rid of it, but at the time I was distracted by how uncannily he resembled me." Maybe I could buy time. Just enough to pack up, get out, and get the Never Die set up with a new paint job and registration number. Maybe a sex change, and one of those cosmetic skin tinting procedures for me. All I had to do was keep moving. "Sir?" asked the security officer. I could feel the imaginary finger resting on the imaginary switch in my head, ready to flip it. But as the moment drew on, all the words I'd prepared dried up and drifted away like autumn leaves. I held out my wrists. "Let's go," I sighed. All tension immediately left the two officials, and the policeman slapped the cuffs on. "Why'd you miss a court appearance, then?" asked the security guard conversationally. "Did you just forget?" "No," I said, pulling my hands apart to test the strength of the chain. But I stopped remembering. I was escorted from the docking bay, walking ahead of the policeman, and the universe continued to turn.
This has been an Audible Studios production of We'll Save the Galaxy for Food, written and performed by Yahtzee Croshaw. Producer Mike Charzik. Copyright 2017 Yahtzee Croshaw. Production copyright 2017 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.